Thank you. So this talk is about, it's about symmetric and asymmetric light dark matter, and it's mostly going to follow a paper written with Haibo Yu and Catherine Zurich at Michigan. And there's also going to be some overlap with a paper written with my advisor, Doug Finkbeiner, and postdoc Sylvia Gallian-Tracy. So before I begin, I guess I just want to say a few words. One is, thanks for allowing me to come here, and I'll try to keep this short because it's the third or fourth or something talk for many of you today. So I'll try to keep it short and simple. Let me know if I don't succeed at any point. So let me begin with a brief introduction. The brief introduction, one sentence, is there's a lot of dark matter. There are lots of models of dark matter, and there are lots of talks about lots of models of dark matter. So the reason is obviously because we don't know what it is, and yet it's 23% of the energy density of the universe. So there are lots of different experimental searches for lots of different models. And many of them focus on WIMP dark matter. But today, what I want to talk about is light dark matter. And I want to use one slide to just motivate that. First, I want to define light dark matter as dark matter with mass between 1 MeV and 10 GeV, roughly. So I made this diagram to illustrate roughly why you might want to think about that range. So I'm just going to restrict the focus to particle dark matter and mostly thermal dark matter. So that's why I'm considering this range of 1 keV to 1030 TeV or so for the dark matter mass. So at the high end, there's this so-called unitarity bound, which says that if the dark matter is too heavy, you just can't get the right relic density for, you know, under making some assumptions. But that does limit what you can consider at the high mass end. Thanks. And at the low mass end, we have warm dark matter, below 1 keV or so, which is constrained from observations of the Lyman alpha forest, basically because you would have free streaming of the dark matter and it would, you know, prevent structure formation. But there is this wide range in between, and around 100 GeV to 1 TeV, we of course have the WIMP miracle, as we heard about today, and the Pamela and Fermi experimental excesses. So the range I want to consider is this this entire range in between, where there are some models of interest, and one I'll talk about is asymmetric dark matter, and there are also a number of there's also some interesting phenomenology. So MeV dark matter was one proposed explanation of the integral 511 keV line was MeV dark matter annihilating in the galactic center. And the proposed explanations of recent direct detection experiments involve light dark matter with masses around 10 GeV. So, and I'm not going to consider below 1 MeV or so, because then you need to annihilate to a new light state. And that just simplifies the discussion a little bit. And so that's why I'm going to consider this 1 MeV to 10 GeV range, where there's some interesting phenomenology. It's not as well studied, and there's been a lot of attention paid to this mass range recently. Okay. So the focus today is light dark matter, but I'm also going to try to be as general as possible. So this slide is supposed to summarize the setup. So I'm going to consider both symmetric and asymmetric. I'll say more about that in a minute. But I'm going to assume dark matter is a fermion, a Dirac fermion, and that it couples to the standard model with through a vector mediator. And again, for simplicity today, I'm just going to focus on the mediator being lighter than the dark matter, just because different constraints become important in the other case. Okay, so then there's just two couplings I'm going to consider, the dark sector coupling of the dark matter to the mediator, and the mediator standard model coupling. So it's the coupling of the mediator to some standard model fermions, which I won't specify now, but through the spectral interaction. And Again, I'm going to assume thermal equilibrium in the early universe. That's because we need to get the right relic density, and this is a particularly simple, this is a particularly predictive assumption. And the last free parameter I'm going to include is some conserved number asymmetry, so allowing the dark matter to carry some conserved number, essentially, conserved dark matter number. And so there's a conserved co-moving number asymmetry, eta x, which I'm going to include. And these are all the parameters of this setup. Okay. So before I begin with the constraints on this, I just want to spend two more slides talking about what the relic density is in this setup. So I said we assumed thermal equilibrium. So that means we have in the symmetric limit, so ignoring the number asymmetry for a moment, we have the usual freeze-out process, and we have the usual relation between the annihilation cross-section and the relic density. Meanwhile, in the asymmetric limit, so for the moment, assume there's more x than x bar for the dark matter. In the asymmetric limit, suppose that there's only x left behind today. So then the relic density is just proportional to the co-moving number asymmetry. And so this was one motivation for looking at light dark matter, because it could explain why the cold dark matter and baryon relic density, the ratio of them was order one if the masses are order one. And there's some physics that requires that the dark matter number asymmetry is the same as the baryon asymmetry. Okay, and there are a bunch of models that can do this through essentially some physics that happens at a very high temperature, a very high scale. So we don't really need to worry about it for our purposes. It's just a free parameter. Now, in general, because I want this number asymmetry to be a free parameter, I need to know what the relic density is interpolating between these two limits, between the totally symmetric and the asymmetric limits. Okay. So what happens is that in general you have, so you always have the asymmetric part because that's a conserved quantity, and then you also have a symmetric thermal abundance. That's because in the early universe, of course, you can produce both x and x bar, so there's always a symmetric part. They're both x and x bar. Then as the universe is cooling, those annihilate away, but at some point the annihilation becomes slow enough that you have freeze out. Now in the case of asymmetric dark matter, you always have the asymmetric part around. So essentially the freeze out of the annihilation doesn't happen as fast as you would think, because you always have that asymmetric part that you can annihilate with. So this symmetric thermal abundance turns out to be exponentially suppressed. So this R, which I'm going to use throughout, is a ratio of x bar over x. So it just measures the amount of the symmetric part. And it's exponentially suppressed in the number asymmetry and the cross-section. The yellow thing is order one numbers, which that's why I've made it yellow. Yeah, it doesn't matter too much. So like M. Planck and stuff, yeah. Well, they're dimensions, but yeah.
Sorry, are those supposed to be pluses in the denominator?
Here, the omega x?
Yeah, or it's really about that.
Yeah, because of this eta x here.
Okay.
Yeah. So, right, so the important thing to remember is just that we have, in general, there's an asymmetric relic density and there's an exponentially suppressed symmetric part, which is exponentially suppressed in the numbered A density and the annihilation cross-section.
But doesn't it require fine-tuning for any sort of hybrid-synchro matter?
Any sort of?
For any sort of hybrid-synchro matter, require fine tuning, right? Because one thing is exponential decrease, one thing is constant.
Yeah, yeah. In general, this exponential part is not. So the reason I'm concerned with the exponential part is because there are very strong bounds on dark matter annihilation, which I'm going to get to. And so you do actually want to know how much of the symmetric part is left, because even a little bit of a symmetric part can result in lots of annihilation and a big indirect signal. But right, in general, you're going to be quickly in one of either of the two limits, asymmetric or symmetric. OK, so that's the setup. Now let me talk about the rest of the talk. So as I mentioned, I'm going to talk about indirect constraints. So sorry, yeah, before I say the outline, the broader idea of the talk is, of our paper and of this talk, is that we want to just take this totally simple and hopefully general setup and look at what the constraints are and then look at what the predictions, if any, are. So, and because a lot of the models that are of interest have overlap with the setup we're considering, we hope that the constraints would be useful for people looking at the models, so that not everyone has to rederive the constraints. So the first thing I want to talk about is C and B constraints on the annihilation of light dark matter, and that's the C and B constraints are particularly important for light dark matter. And then I want to talk about the halo shape constraint. So that bounds the dark matter self interaction. And that's a weaker constraint, but it does put a constraint on the mediator mass. And then in the third part, I just want to talk about the direct detection signals for light dark matter and how in applying the constraints of the first two sections, plus a few more constraints, what the parameter space of direct detection cross sections is. Okay, so the setup is just light dark matter with a light mediator. What are the constraints and what is the direct detection signal? Okay. So before I talk about the physics of the C and B constraints, I just want to emphasize the basic ideas of this section. So the first is that the C and B constraints I'm talking about depend only on the average density of the dark matter, and they don't depend on the dark matter halo shape, halo properties today. So it's a particularly robust constraint on dark matter annihilation, and I'm not going to talk about any other indirect constraints because they do depend on these late time astrophysics. So I'll also talk a little bit about how you can, so the paper written with my advisor and Sylvia Galli and Tracy Sattier, where we derived we study this in a very general way, and we showed that you can get model-independent bounds. So that's the second thing. One is that it doesn't depend on astrophysics much, and you can get very model-independent bounds. It's also important for cosmologists, of course, if they want to get the cosmological parameters right. And relevant to this talk is that it's a very strong constraint on light dark matter because the relevant power scales is 1 over mass.
So how light would one go, how light the mass can Planck?
Planck goes up to, WMAP, it depends on the annihilation channel.
I mean, you have to detect those photons in terms of how low energy can that go?
So we're assuming, okay, so I guess, I'm not sure how to answer this question right now.
Or ask another way. We can leave it for later, that's fine. But just as you said correctly, the power goes, you really increase as you go to lower mass, but at some point you just cannot detect those photons.
Well, we're not detecting the photons exactly here. We're detecting the ionization resulting from those photons. So once the photons are light, are low enough that they don't ionize anything, that's one, yeah. So, yeah. But that's very, very low. Okay, and so the C and B constraints will lead to a minimum annihilation cross-section for asymmetric dark matter, which is slightly different from what you'd expect in the symmetric case, because more annihilation leads to more signal, of course. And that will lead to a minimum coupling in the dark sector. So now I'm going to start talking about the physics of what's actually happening. But before that, I just want to note that these bounds actually apply for both the heavy and light mediator cases, even though I am considering just the light mediator case today. OK. So here's the basic picture of how dark matter annihilation affects the CMB. So the CMB is basically photons that are coming to us after they stop scattering off electrons. So as soon as the free electron fraction becomes sufficiently small, so enough electrons become bound, then the universe is essentially transparent. That happens around redshift 1000, and then the photons stop scattering. And if you have dark matter annihilation, this will lead to additional ionization, because you inject lots of high energy stuff, which then lead to additional ionizations. So the CMB, because of this, the CMB is particularly sensitive to the ionization fraction, and therefore, sensitive to dark matter annihilation, because dark matter annihilation increases the amount of ionization. Okay, so here's a plot of what I just said. The first one is the ionization fraction versus redshift. So early on, the universe is ionized. And this black line is, the standard cosmology. So early on, the universe is ionized. And then through recombination, the ionization fraction drops off, but then it freezes out at some value. And if you have dark matter annihilation, these colored lines show what happened. Your ionization fraction still freezes out, but it just freezes out at a higher value. So effectively, that means that the photon has a given photon has a greater probability of scattering again at some redshift, like say 600. So that's what this bottom plot is. It's the probability that of when a photon last scattered. So here, a photon has a much larger probability of scattering at later redshifts. Okay, and that leads to suppression in the CMB power spectrum. So here, these black lines are again the standard CMB power spectrum for standard cosmology. And the dashed lines are what happens if you include a very large amount of dark matter annihilation, much larger than is currently allowed. Okay? So the dark matter annihilation leads to a damping of the modes. Essentially, these lines are going down. And this is constrained by WMAP. And with the addition of the polarization, so these two, you can get much stronger constraints from Planck. Okay. So in the symmetric case, the power that's relevant from dark matter is basically some efficiency function times the annihilation cross-section over the mass. That's because we know the energy density of dark matter, but not the number density. So there's an efficiency that one has to be concerned with, this f of z. And it's just because we know that sometimes you produce neutrinos in annihilations, which don't result in ionization. And also because some photons actually just ionize inefficiently lead to ionizations. So in general, you have dark matter annihilation to lots of stuff, which cascade down to photons, electrons, and neutrinos. And then there's a further electromagnetic cascade until you get to sort of KeV, below MeV energy, photons, and that leads to the ionizations. But in general, the effect on the CMB isn't very sensitive to the spectrum of annihilation products, but only the total energy that's dumped in a single dark matter annihilation. So the details of this are not very important, and it can essentially be captured by its efficiency being, you know, between 20 and 90%, depending on the annihilation channel. Okay, and so here's my one slide summarizing the results of this paper. In general, there is a redshift dependent function, which is very complicated. And I said that you can parameterize it by an effective efficiency. But if you wanted to consider much more general dark matter models, in this paper, we derive a basis expansion for this power in terms of these basis functions. And we show that you just need three parameters to describe a more general energy injection function. Okay, but
so the energy injection function depends on the annihilation channel. I mean, if it's S-wheel annihilation or P-wheel annihilation.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that I'm going to assume is in here, or it can be in either one of these, but yeah.
So it's constrained for P-wheel annihilation, but recurrent.
Yeah. Yeah, so for P-wave, there's essentially no constraint, I guess. Yeah. Okay, so here are the constraints. So back to the main line, I guess. Here are the constraints in the symmetric case, for those of you who haven't seen this before. So it's in this efficiency times annihilation cross-section versus mass. And of course, since you're only constraining the power, you get these contours. Everything to the left of this line is excluded by WMAP 5, and you have Planck and potentially some cosmic variance limited experiment. So everything below about 10 GeV is excluded if you're annihilating mostly to electrons. That's the most efficient case because you don't have any neutrinos. So that's the range that's relevant for light dark matter, but you also have these Sommerfeld enhanced models, which are also severely constrained and potentially will be ruled out very soon by Planck or detected. Okay, so this looks bad for light dark matter unless, one possibility that was mentioned was it's just P wave suppressed. So if it's interacting through a scalar mediator instead, that's one way to get around these bounds. This line is the thermal relic, the standard thermal relic cross section. I got to say that. So you can't get the right relic density unless it's either P wave suppressed or asymmetric. So in the asymmetric case, you can just suppress the amount of the symmetric abundance, and that just leads to a very suppressed signal.
So back to the previous issue. But so let's go down in mass to MEV.
Mm-hmm.
At what point does this plot become irrelevant?
I don't know the number, but
maybe just what would be the reason why this becomes irrelevant? Is it just the injectors are not energetic enough to ionize?
Yeah, one would be it just doesn't ionize anything. Another could be if some other process becomes much more efficient than ionization, like heating or something like that. That hasn't been calculated in detail. So yeah, it's actually not very well known, I guess.
Right,
or if you go to electrons. Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
So is it typically such that if you inject a highly energetic gamma that you end up with many, many gammas?
Right, you end up with many, many low energy gammas.
Right.
What's that?
So this is driving the process, the photon multiplying power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the photon goes to many low energy, MEV photons, let's say, which then can ionize more efficiently. So it's just that, high energy photon actually doesn't ionize anything very often. It's not very efficient at ionizing things, where high energy means like GeV. But it can, you know, pair production, stuff like that, can allow the high energy photon to lead to MeV photons, which can then ionize.
So does the multiplicity in the cascade depend strongly on the primary injection energy?
The multiplicity isn't so important as the total amount of energy that's. So again, assuming that they're all relative high enough energy, mostly high enough energy to ionize, it doesn't matter too much what the multiplicity is, just the total amount of energy that's done. So there's a paper that there's a paper from Scholl and Van Steenberg which calculates this in detail, or they have a model for this, which just says that below MeV or so, you just have some fraction of the energy going to ionization, and the number of ionizations is essentially that energy divided by 13.6. So this is a model for how it happens. I think there are people working on better, more detailed calculations of this, but this is what's assumed for now. More questions about this? Okay. So those were the constraints for the symmetric case. And in the asymmetric case, or more generally, I also have this factor in front where R was the ratio, essentially the ratio of the symmetric to asymmetric parts. So you get a suppression just because there's nothing to annihilate. That was this exponentially suppressed bit. So because it's exponentially suppressed, you might expect that even though cranking up the annihilation cross-section would increase the power generally, of course, it appears in the exponential, so you can get a suppression. So that's the reason in the asymmetric case we need a higher annihilation cross-section. Because even though there's more annihilation, you can much more efficiently just get rid of the symmetric part, because freeze-out happens later. So I think I'll just skip these. OK. So that leads to this bound on the annihilation cross-section for the symmetric component. So what this plot is, this is mass versus the annihilation cross-section. So the black line is showing the annihilation cross-section you need for the correct relic density in the symmetric case. And if you now allow for a free parameter, which is the number asymmetry, you essentially get these bounds. So, okay, so first of all, this line is, of course, ruled out below 1 to 10 GeV or so, unless you very efficiently annihilate to neutrinos or something. So this line is ruled out. So you can get around it by increasing the asymmetry, or equivalently, just take the asymmetry as a free parameter. How much do you have to increase the annihilation cross-section such that, one, you get the right relic density, and two, you can avoid these CMB bounds. So that's what these lines are. Okay, so it just requires a slightly higher annihilation cross-section than you would normally expect, but it's not very dramatic because of the exponential, of course. And the bottom plot is the maximum asymmetry. So even though you don't need a much larger annihilation cross-section, you do need a very small symmetric component. So like at 1 GeV, you need 10 to the minus 3 symmetric component or something. Okay. So let me summarize the CMB constraints. So the CMB constraints were one of the more robust limits on dark matter annihilation through the effect on the ionization history. And so this was very important for light dark matter. And generally, the ways around that are, one, you have a P wave suppression. So that's just if the annihilation cross-section is velocity suppressed at the time of the CMB. Another is, if you, for some reason, you annihilate only to neutrinos. And the one I presented some plots for were for the asymmetric case. So these are three sort of generic ways getting around the CMB bounds for light dark matter. And in the asymmetry case, what you get from the minimum annihilation cross section is just a minimum hidden sector coupling, and this is the main thing that I'll use in the direct detection section. Just that you get a minimum alpha x. Okay, so that wraps up the CMB section. Are there any more questions about this?
How do you change the spectrum of the CMB? You said that it delays the recombination time.
Mm-hmm.
What was about this James mass for the baryonic matter that oscillates during the last scattering? How does it also change the size of this oscillation modes? It's just changing the
Yeah, it's not even changing the recombination time very much. It's only changing the ionization after recombination. So maybe if I go back here. So this is kind of the probability of when it last scattered. So if this peak were to shift, then you would say it's changing when recombination is happening, because the location of the peak is, you know, around 1,000 is where it's happening. So it doesn't change that location very much. It's mostly just increasing this tail. So I think the effects.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This one?
Yeah, this one.
Mm-hmm.
So,
the dashed line is including some dark matter annihilation. Yeah, so it's mostly just suppressing the power spectrum above some L mode. Just by making the universe slightly less transparent at those intermediate redshifts. Does that answer the question, or? Okay. Okay. So the second part of the talk is about halo shape constraints on dark matter self-interaction. So I've been assuming that there's a light mediator in this setup. And if you have a light mediator, that means more dark matter self-scattering. And this has a number of effects on dark matter halo shapes, which lead to constraints on the self-scattering. So just for reference, here's the elastic scattering cross-section in terms of the hidden sector coupling. And it's 1 over the mass of the mediator to the fourth. And here I'm assuming it's a short-range interaction. And later I'll show that later this is self-consistent. But for now, just assume it's a short-range interaction. And so when we get a bound on this self-interaction cross-section, this will imply a lower limit on the mass of the mediator. OK. So the physical effects of a dark matter self-interaction on what we observe is, well, observe indirectly, is that it leads to heat conduction and dark matter halos. So essentially, you can have a very loosely bound elliptical orbit scatter off of a dark matter particle near the center of the dark matter halo. And that can lead to transfer of kinetic energy between the outer parts of the halo and the inner parts of the halo. So, or another way to think of it is that you have an unbound dark matter particle coming in. It scatters off of some particle near the center of this galaxy or cluster. And then it loses energy and it becomes bound. So this leads to formations of cores in these dark matter halos. So the conventional scenario is that you get these very cuspy profiles. So you get or another way to say it is very steep profiles near the centers of dark matter halos. But if you have self-interaction, you get much shallower profiles, radial profiles for the density, sorry. It also leads to more isotropic halos, again, because if you have very elliptical halos, the self-interaction of the scattering will just lead to kinetic energy transfer, and that will make the halo much more isotropic. So these things can be constrained, and initially such a self-interaction was proposed to improve agreement with certain observations. But for hard sphere scattering, it's rather constrained, so that's where I'm going to focus on today, just the constraints on hard sphere scattering. And for velocity-dependent scattering, you can get interesting, you can evade these constraints and also improve agreement with certain observations. But again, today I'll just do hard sphere scattering. It will also lead to a larger dark disk, I guess, or probably a more massive, more important dark disk. But I think at this level of interaction, it won't lead to a completely disk-like halo. For the cross sections I'm talking about. Eventually, if you increase if you allow for dissipation and you increase the cross section enough, presumably it would just form a dark disk. Okay. So the first constraint. I'm going to go in order of increasing strength of the constraint. The first constraint comes from the bullet cluster. So probably everyone's seen this. There's the X-ray image of a cluster and subcluster. There's also the lensing image, which is these contours. So that's where the dark matter is, and that's where the gas is. And you can use this to get a simple constraint on the dark matter self-interaction. So if you look at the system and you say that this collision happened, it looks like a merger where the gas got dragged behind. If you look at this merger and say, as this cluster passed through this one, it didn't lose a significant fraction of its dark matter particles, right? Then you can get a constraint on the, so you have some scattering, some mean, surface density as this cluster passed through that one, and you also have a cross-section over mass. And from this, you can get a constraint on the cross-section, about 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared. Okay? And the relevant, some of the relevant numbers in this system are collision velocity of 4,000 kilometers per second, some average density of below GeV per centimeters cubed, and the size of this cluster is about 100 kiloparsec. And the only reason I mention these is because that the different constraints I'm talking about come from rather different scales. And so this is just an analytic estimate, but it was supported by some simulations of the merger, including this interaction cross-section in 2007. So this is it's the weakest constraint on self-interaction, but it's probably also the most well-understood one, because it just involves one event, essentially. Okay. The other constraints come from these halo shapes I was talking about, so making halos more cored or more shallow and also more spherical. So if you look at certain dark matter clusters or certain clusters of galaxies and their dark matter halos, you can see that the inferred dark matter halo is very elliptical compared to, intuitively the more spherical one. So you can estimate that roughly, again, by taking just some interaction rate, which depends on the velocity dispersion, the density at some radius. So you assume that, or what you observe is that the halo is elliptical up to some, at some radius, say 70 kiloparsecs. So, so taking that distance from the center of the halo, and typical some typical velocity dispersion, you can get a bound on the bound on the cross section, which is about one or two orders of magnitude stronger. So, so this was studied in, by looking at analytical estimates in this paper. And it's supported somewhat by simulations, later simulations of self interaction.
Mm-hmm. Just to understand maybe the physics behind it. So if I think about a galaxy, I think about it as a gas, and if it's really it's not spherical, then it has a sort of an effective temperature which is not isotropic.
Mm-hmm.
So is the point just that the interaction will tend to evenly distribute the temperature so that it's
right.
End up being spherical?
Right, because the interaction just leads to momentum transfer, then it will distribute the, it will essentially distribute the dark matter, so it's more puffy and spherical, rather than cuspy and elliptical. And so the reason because the interaction strength goes with the number density, you just want to look as far in as possible. So, the ellipticity of this some particular cluster in this case was measured into about 70 kiloparsecs. So it could be still that the very center there's still some interaction, but at large length scales it still looks like cold dark matter, so you're safe. Okay. And on even smaller scales you have elliptical dark matter halos. So this is like this is a single galaxy, which is shown here, single elliptical galaxy, and observations of the gas, which is this color stuff. And from that, again, detailed modeling. So there's detailed modeling of this particular system, and from that, assuming standard dark matter halo profiles, the best fit profile has some ellipticities. and that leads to an even stronger constraint in this case because you're going to even smaller length scales. So the number density is even higher now for about 4 GeV. And,
but at such, such low radius, dark matter is not even the dominant component, is it?
In this particular example, it still is a good fraction. I can't remember the number, but one of the reasons they didn't go into they didn't use even smaller radii was because the dark matter was no longer dominant. I can't remember the number, but it is a good fraction. And there have also been some simulations of dark matter plus baryons, which suggest that it doesn't. That the baryons only increase the ellipticity. But, yeah.
That will go into supporting that dark matter could have higher interaction. Because you're supporting the ellipticity with the normal matter and you are causing sphericity with dark matter.
Yeah, maybe it went the other way. It goes in the way that. I can't remember. It must be the other way then. So that's one warning, of course, of using these constraints is that first the analytic constraint you don't really trust in the first place, and then you want to go to simulations, but the simulations don't include baryons. So that's one warning to using these. Another one is that both of these papers that derived bounds were just using one particular case. So this constraint used one particular cluster, and this constraint used this particular elliptical galaxy. And that, again, is a dangerous thing because, of course, in reality, you have a distribution of of different halo shapes for, given some amount of dark matter self-interaction. So there is some work that's going into simulations of these and figuring out how you can derive better bounds, not using just one case, but you know, more general, well, using statistics, I guess. But this is the strongest bound that you can get just from simple estimates. Mm-hmm. Oh, 5 minutes? Oops. Okay. All right, so that leads to a lower bound on the mediator mass, essentially because lighter mediators, of course, lead to more self-interaction. So I just mentioned at the beginning that this was a short-range interaction. So if you just take the bound on the mediator mass that you get out of this, you can just see that it's self-consistent. So that's all I want to say about that. Okay. So the summary of the halo shape section was that there are a number of different bounds on dark matter self-interaction which lead to a bound on the mediator mass. Are there any more questions about that section? Okay. So, oh, yeah.
The physics of this you're saying that is it due to the annihilation of dark matter? It loses energy but keeps the angular momentum and then...
It's not the annihilation, just the self-scattering. So just elastic scattering of dark matter on dark matter.
So how change the... How's the shape?
Momentum is annihilation. Redistributes the momentum.
So if you have...
You're going this way really fast, you're collided with another one, now you're going this way really fast. So if there was any sort of distribution of matter, you can think about it as kind of a temperature, right? Maybe we should leave it for a discussion because she has a whole section to talk about.
Yeah, let's go. Okay, so the last section is about direct detection of light dark matter. So, let's see. Okay, so this section I want to combine the constraints I talked about earlier plus a few more constraints to get the range of direct detection cross sections. So it's essentially just like taking, given this setup, what is the parameter space? Is it interesting? And so I'll consider two different cases because, so usually direct detection means scattering off of nucleons. But of course, a 10 MeV dark matter is not going to give much energy if it hits a nucleon to a nucleus. So in this range of 1 MeV to 1 GeV, I'll just consider electron scattering. Okay. So I'm just going to summarize what happens here quickly. So the nucleon cross-section depends on Hinze sector coupling and the coupling of the mediator to the standard model, of course. And again, it's 1 over mediator mass to the fourth. So I can get a number of simple bounds on this. And so one bound I mentioned was a lower bound on this coupling from the CMB constraints. And I can also bound this coupling of the mediator to the standard model because I want the mediator to decay sufficiently fast, essentially. Otherwise, if you produce the mediator in the early universe, it's just going to sit around and overclose the universe. So if I require that the mediator decays to standard model fermions by BBN, that leads to a bound. So I can combine these to get a lower bound on this cross-section. And then I can get an upper bound on this cross-section because I have an upper bound on the self-interaction. So essentially, this can be rewritten in terms of the self-interaction cross-section here. And this coupling, which I can also constrain, for example, from the muon anomalous magnetic moment. So they're just two simple applications of the constraints I talked about. And they essentially lead to a lower bound, which is extremely out of range of detection, which is 10 to the minus 55 centimeters squared, and an upper bound, which is way above current limits from CREST or xenon 10. So in this case, I would say it's, these are not particularly interesting constraints, but I'll use them again for the electron case. So that's why I mentioned them. Okay. So that was nucleon scattering. So electron scattering, which is exactly the same except for this should be a mu e. The reduced mass is now the electron, dark matter reduced mass, and it's the coupling of the electrons. So this hasn't been directly searched for, but there's some work that's going on in looking at detection methods or using current data to get constraints on this, electron scattering cross-section. So again, I get a very depressing lower bound, which is way below detection, and a very high upper bound from combining halo shapes and electron, this time electron anomalous magnetic moment. And the only other constraint that's different that I want to apply is from constraints on dark gauge bosons. So this is in mediator mass and coupling to electron in that parameter space. So there's basically a large region which is ruled out, which is this colored stuff. And we need to apply those constraints as well. So I'm just going to summarize the rest of our paper, which was that we combined all of those constraints, so from CMB, HALO, BBN, as well as these constraints on the dark gauge boson, in order to get the final result, which is a rather funky allowed parameter space for the direct detection cross-section, which is this green region. Okay, and the short version of the story is that this large region, which is ruled out in mediator mass and electron coupling, translates to this ruled out region in electron scattering cross-section and dark matter mass. Okay, so that wraps up the direct detection section. So I just want to conclude by saying we looked at dark matter of masses from 1 MeV to 10 GeV with light mediators. So we made those assumptions, but otherwise kept it fairly general, and looked at the most general astrophysical bounds from coming from the CMB and from halo shapes. And from there, derived the range of direct detection cross-sections for nucleon scattering and electron scattering. And we hope it's useful in terms of looking at the parameter space of dark matter models and also for people looking to apply bounds on their particular model. Thank you. The power spectrum peaks?
Yes.
It does change the polarization peaks a little bit.
Position.
Yeah, it shifts them a little bit.
With what?
About
temperature. It doesn't change the temperature also?
Of the power spectrum peak?
Power spectrum, yes.
What do you mean by what temperature then?
You have the TT.
I can go back. It's kind of slow though. So it doesn't really change the TT peaks very much. If you stare at TE, you can see that this peak is like off by from that peak.
It's strange because it changed the time of the combination, and then the last scattering surface in this case is closer to us.
Oh, and yeah,
so
right.
You have a larger angular size of the acoustic.
Yeah, it doesn't actually change the location of the last scattering surface much, which is what this plot was trying to show. So essentially, if you include dark matter, it's this colored one. It's the peak is almost at the same location. It's just because the universe is already so ionized here, you can't change it that much. So even at 1100, the ionization fraction is high enough. If dark matter is only affecting at the 10 to the minus 4 level, you're not going to change an ionization fraction of 0.1 very much. So that's why it doesn't really affect the position of the peak.
occur again?